You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's episode is brought to you by our supporters on Patreon, including our Commodore class. That's Commodores, Obvious, Scurvy Legs, Nikita, Brendan, Kruger, MD, Torso, Big Beard, Schmarls, Josiah, Jack, Logan, Cannon Monkey, Lost Again, The Navigator, Axios, The Knight of Dampier, Wit, Pablo, Willie P, Governor Roop, Gin-Soaked Jim, Ward, Workman, Rum Runner, Skipper, Drunken Dak, Eric the Red, The Pirate Nopales, Hefe, Matthew the Navigator, Bull, Vertigon, Rumgut, and Bootstraps Bailey. And I'd like to welcome our newest patron, Greg, and our newest Commodore. Welcome to the crew, Commodore Pinches. Hello. Welcome to the Pirate History Podcast. My name is Matt. Thank you for listening. I told you last time about a clandestine, worldwide illicit trade ring, a group of rich merchants and planters in coalition with the dregs of society, interlopers and smugglers, rum runners and pirates. That coalition stretched from Madagascar to Nassau in the Bahamas, and then up to the British colonies in North America, New York with the likes of Frederick Phillips, and to the Carolina colony. But that last bit, Carolina, I brushed past last time. We haven't talked much about Carolina yet. Massachusetts, New York, Madagascar, we've introduced all of them, but Carolina, well, it holds kind of a special place in the story of the pirates. In our story, it really hasn't popped up yet. Virginia was more prominent when the buccaneers were roaming the seas, but moving forward, well, Blackbeard, Charles Vane, Stede Bonnet. I mean, at the end of Black Sails, Captain Flint winds up at Savannah. There's a host of sunken pirate ships and buried treasures that grace the Carolina coast. The swamps of Carolina were always there as a kind of last resort for the pirates. So today we're going to talk about Carolina in some depth, really introduce it, from the founding of the colony to the current point in our overall story. This is episode 194, The Rogue's Harbor. There is one person in particular that interests us in Carolina, a doctor that we mentioned last time who was part, an integral part, of that international illegal slave trading ring. He was one part explorer and one part doctor and one part buccaneer. His name was Dr. Henry Woodward. But we can't really talk about the founder of Carolina without discussing how the colony itself came to be. The English had been attempting to colonize the region for decades now. Their first attempt came under Queen Elizabeth in the failed colony at Roanoke. And then a bit later on, King Charles I laid claim to Carolina and gave it its name in 1629. He issued a land grant to Attorney General Robert Heath, but that second attempt to colonize Carolina fizzled out almost as hard as Roanoke did. After the Civil Wars, Oliver Cromwell's Western design more or less ignored Carolina. He was focusing instead on Port Royal, and Jamaica, the Caribbean in general. But then in 1660, Charles II was restored to the throne. The latter Stuarts had big plans for the Carolinas. Charles II loved the name, after the French version of Charles, and he planned to use Carolina land grants to secure his base of support back in England. 8 of the most powerful nobles that supported his restoration to the throne were named Lords Proprietor in the 1663 Charter of Carolina. Those 8 names are all names that we would recognize, but 2 in particular stand out. The first of those, well, in fact, the name on the charter is George Monk, the first Duke of Albemarle, but it's really his son Christopher Monk who's much more important. We all should know who Christopher Monk is. He was Henry Morgan's patron in 1672 when Morgan was brought up on charges. He was the most important figure in Jamaican politics for decades. He had significant interests in Virginia and now, in 1663, in Carolina. He's the Duke of Albemarle. Even before the 1663 charter, even before the Restoration, Albemarle had interest in Carolina. There were settlers from his land in Virginia that were moving south into what would later come to be called Albemarle Sound. But the Albemarle Sound had another name. They called it the Rogue's Harbor. In part, that's because Albemarle Sound provided an almost infinite number of coves and inlets that ran deep into the countryside. They were perfect places for pirates and smugglers to hide out. The land that surrounded the sound was largely swampland. That's where a bunch of wild species like the Venus flytrap originate. And before they drained the Carolina swamplands, it was nearly unthinkable to settle on most of the coastline. You're not likely to build a house or grow crops there, so no one was going to spot a hidden pirate ship from the landward side. Rogue's Harbor was a fitting name for the colony. The second Lord Proprietor is another figure that we should know. We've met him before, but not in real depth. His name was Edward Hyde, 1st Earl of Clarendon, and Hyde was a major figure in English politics. I could recite his list of titles and positions held, but these episodes can only be so long, so instead of that, I'll point out that Edward Hyde's daughter, Anne Hyde, married the future King James II. Both Queen Mary II and Queen Anne were his granddaughters. The Duke of Albemarle and Earl of Clarendon were both staunch supporters of the Stuarts. That's how they got included on the charter. But personally, they were at odds with one another. There wasn't, like, a super passionate hatred between the two, but they were rivals professionally. Now, the Carolina Charter granted the Lord's Proprietor land that stretched from the 36th parallel north to the 31st parallel north. Those are latitudinal lines that stretched, in the eyes of England, from the Atlantic to the Pacific. The 36th parallel is a bit south of the modern border between Virginia and North Carolina. It wasn't exactly in the same spot, but that would sort itself out later on. The 31st parallel is more interesting, though. It equates roughly to the modern border between Georgia and Florida. That is a not insignificant amount of land, even ignoring the impossibility that it would ever stretch to the Pacific Ocean. That's 3 modern states' worth of territory. But that was by design, as there were several Lords Proprietor named in the charter. Almost immediately, Carolina began to be divvied up between 2 sides among the Lords Proprietor. To the north, there was the Albemarle Province, sometimes even then called Northern or North Carolina. To the south, there was the Clarendon Province, sometimes called Southern or South Carolina. Now, officially, they would remain a single political entity until 1712, when North and South Carolina would split. And then, in 1732, Georgia would split off. But the differences between the Albemarle and Clarendon provinces were apparent to everyone immediately. Pirates as much as anyone. To put it Very broadly, from the purview of the pirates, North Carolina was just way cooler than South Carolina. For a number of reasons, mainly it was their far superior barbecue. But really, what I mean here is that North Carolina was a lot more lenient toward illegal and semi-legal activity. Pirates, smuggling, that kind of thing. I mean, what kind of a monster uses mustard as a barbecue sauce base? No, stay on track. The big difference between North and South Carolina, ideologically, is that North Carolina was much more accepting of different religious sects. They had Quakers and Calvinists and Huguenots. Most of the Puritans in America stayed up in the Bible Commonwealth, and most Anglicans preferred Virginia or, now, South Carolina. But North Carolina, the Albemarle province, much like New York, became a haven for religious exiles from all over the world. It's interesting to me that so many places which were more accepting of religious freedom and thus accepted exiles became havens for piratical activity. I don't exactly know what conclusions to draw from that. People at the time would have told you it was the moral degradation of those inferior denominations, or maybe they'd get super xenophobic about the whole thing and tell you it's all those filthy foreigners, clearly a French influence. Personally, I think it's economic. English trade was still deep in the mercantile system and highly regulated. Non-English inhabitants of colonial holdings enjoyed fewer rights, especially in the trading market. So those exiles had to turn to illegal methods of trade. And that, of course, brings in merchant shipping willing to engage in illegal activity at sea, which really is only a few steps removed from outright piracy. But there is another possible explanation. In her 1917 book, The Story of the United States, Henrietta Elizabeth Marshall writes, quote, "The Protestants of France were called Huguenots, and they had to suffer at the hands of Catholic rulers. Louis XIV, who was at this time on the throne of France, forbade the Huguenots to worship God in their own way, and also he forbade them to leave the country on pain of death. But thousands braved death rather than remain and be false to their religion. Some were caught and cruelly punished, but many succeeded in escaping to Holland, England, and even to America. Many Huguenots now settled in Carolina. They were hard-working, high-minded people, and they brought a sturdiness and grit to the colony which it might otherwise have lacked. Germans, too, came from the Palatinate, driven thence also by religious persecutions. Irish Presbyterians fleeing from persecution in Ulster. Jacobites who, having fought for the Stuarts, found Scotland no longer a safe dwelling place, came seeking a new home. These were all hardy, industrious people. But besides these, there came many worthless idlers. These came because, in the early days, when the colony was but sparsely peopled, and more settlers were wanted, a law was passed that a new settler need not pay any debts he had made before he came to the colony. And, for a year after he came, he need pay no taxes. These laws brought, of course, many shiftless folk who, having got hopelessly into debt somewhere else, ran away to Carolina to get free of it. Indeed, so many of these undesirables came that the Virginians called Carolina the Rogue's Harbor." End quote. Now that passage, well, I've got some issues with it. It does give a good breakdown of the Protestant immigrants to the Carolina colony, and a good, reasonable at least, explanation of why it was called the Rogue's Harbor. What it does not do is give us a fair reason why so many of those debtors were forced to come to America in the first place. She paints them as lazy, unindustrious, undesirables. She even, at one point, calls them poor whites, which is full of its own super racist, post-slavery American connotations. But in her estimation, it was all very much their own fault. In reality, the debt system in most of Europe at the time was built specifically to keep even the hard-working people in an endless cycle of debt. It's how you deal if you are a rich landowner with the abolition of feudalism. But it's not a terrible passage. The rest of the book gets pretty abysmal. Marshall's account of slavery and the rice fields of Carolina is even worse, but we're going to get to that rice in a minute. For now, that's North Carolina. But South Carolina, the Clarendon province, well, they had bigger problems. That 31st parallel, the modern Georgia-Florida line, was Spanish territory. More accurately, or technically, it was really Indian territory, north of St. Augustine. And it's difficult to pin down who exactly lived where and for how long when it comes to Native American peoples at the time. The land between the Appalachian Mountains and the Atlantic Ocean was in turmoil. In modern South Carolina, you would find tribes like the Kofitachekee and Kusabo peoples. Down south of that, closer to the Savannah River, you would find the Tama and Guile peoples. But the dominant force in the region, the largest grouping, the most militarily powerful Native American tribe, was the Muscogee, also called the Creek people. Due to European encroachment from Spain and England mainly, they formed the Muscogee Confederation, a large military alliance that stretched from Florida to Virginia. Now, all of those other tribes that I just mentioned were not technically part of the Confederation, for the most part, but they fed and supplied this military alliance, and occasionally some of them sent warriors to ride with the Muscogee. That Confederation kept the encroaching French and English interests at bay, but as for the Spanish, they had, well, they weren't friends exactly. You might call them mortal frenemies. The Spanish were permitted to build missions in Muscogee land, but they were not permitted any large settlements north of St. Augustine. In return, the Spanish supplied their allies with guns. Now, this did occasionally come back to bite them. The Spanish and Muscogee did fight from time to time, but by and large, Spain was happy with the arrangement. This large and Spanish-supported, militarily powerful Native American coalition created kind of a no-man's land between Florida and Virginia. It protected the northern border of Spain's West Indian colonies, Florida, from England. This arrangement had been in place for generations now, almost since the time of Columbus, at least he was still alive when it came into being. But it began to crumble when tribes from the north immigrated down to the south. In the 1650s, England started moving their forces into Canada, French territory. This set off the resumption of the Beaver Wars between the Algonquin and Iroquois peoples. We've mentioned all of that before. But at first in these resumed Beaver Wars, the English and the Iroquois did really, really well. They pushed a bunch of Algonquin people off of their land. However, rather than just, you know, murder them all, the English offered the Algonquins a proposition. "Look," they said, "there is a bunch of land down to the south. It's lush and it's warm and it's fertile. But it's also occupied. If you do, though, want to go down there and take it, we'll help you out. We'll supply you with guns and horses and food and clothing, and we'll set you up with a trade alliance so that we can both prosper together. And beyond that, you won't ever have to come back into contact with the hated Iroquois. You'll have new land, and you'll have us backing you 100%. To their credit, this was not some kind of dirty trick. The Algonquin were given food and clothing. Food and clothes that weren't rancid or infested with smallpox. The horses that the English gave them were healthy pack animals mostly, but they were good for breeding. The English in all of this kept their word. And once the Algonquin reached Virginia's southern border, they were in fact handed lots of guns. Pretty good guns, not the best maybe, but fine firearms and plenty of shot and powder to go along with it. Then they were just sent on their way, to travel south to settle new homes in the beautiful American Southeast. What a friendly bunch of folks these English are, right? There are those contemporary histories that would have you believe that the Algonquin people were tricked into this, but I don't think that's the case. They weren't stupid. They'd already been allied with the French, but they'd been defeated. But here they were given another chance. They'd have to switch their alliance to the English and fight an unfamiliar people in an unfamiliar land, but, well, it's better than genocide. Which gave rise, in the late 1650s, to a new war between these Algonquin people from up in Canada and the Muscogee Confederation in Georgia, South, and North Carolina. Within about 10 years, the Muscogee were pushed south of the Savannah River, and there they held the line. But the English-allied Algonquin held what we would later call Carolina. This all sets the stage pretty perfectly for the English to found new cities and forts all along the coast. Now, this was all still dangerous. Spain still considered that land theirs. Or, you know, not theirs exactly, but the Muscogee, but definitely not England's. Every attempt by the English and the French to settle anywhere near Florida had been met with battle and burning and massacre. It was all pretty horrific. You'll recall that Francis Drake made great hay out of one such instance. But Spain made their position very clear. Do not settle here. You can have the cold part of the continent, but move too close and we will kill you. Which brings us to 1666, and an expedition planned and funded by the 8 Lords Proprietor. An expedition to be led by Sir Robert Sandford. An expedition that employed a surgeon out of Barbados named Dr. Henry Woodward. The actual mission itself isn't particularly interesting. It was less a voyage of exploration and more a mission to establish trade ties with the Native Americans in the region. Sandford met with a number of tribes and chiefs, but most notably for our story, the Kusabo. Their chief agreed to an exchange of people. Not a prisoner exchange or a hostage exchange exactly, but Dr. Woodward was going to stay with the Kusabo while one of the chief's daughters would sail off with the English. In theory, when both are returned safe and hopefully not pregnant, there will be trust built between the two sides. What we know about this period of time in Dr. Woodward's life is limited. He did keep kept notes. It's all about language and flora and fauna and what crops might grow well in Carolina. There's nothing about the day-to-day, not even the big things. For example, we don't know how Henry Woodward wound up in St. Augustine as a guest of the Spanish. We don't know if he was a prisoner exactly. Maybe he was, and there are records in London that suggest as much. And it's those records that tell us most of what we know about this period in Woodward's life. For example, he had been given a huge piece of land in Carolina from the Lord's Proprietor. It looks like, most probably, the Spanish may have caught wind of that English expedition to the Carolina colony and sailed north to see what exactly was going on, hopefully to intercept them. But by the time the Spanish arrived, most of the Englishmen had gone. Woodward was the only man left. So the Spanish arrested him. We do know that Woodward would spend almost a year in St. Augustine. He would serve as a doctor during that time and convert to Catholicism. And, well, we do have a number of letters and records by Dr. Woodward to Spanish officials there in St. Augustine. But none of those are written in Spanish. They're written in Latin. Woodward didn't speak Spanish, at least not when he arrived, but he would learn. He was kind of a genius when it came to language. English, Spanish, Latin, probably Dutch, and a host of Southeastern Native American languages. He spoke a ton of tongues. But all of this, the serving as a doctor, the converting to Catholicism, it may have been under duress as a prisoner. It looks like he was held against his will. When, later on, an opportunity to escape arose, when it fell into his lap, Henry Woodward jumped at the chance. This happened in 1668. Let me set the stage here. Port Royal, Jamaica was, at exactly this time, just growing to the heights of piratical activity that would make it the wickedest city on all the earth. Earlier that year, Henry Morgan had attacked Portobello, and he was on his way to Maracaibo. The Brethren of the Coast, from Tortuga mainly, were wreaking havoc all over the West Indies. Aside from Morgan, probably the most prominent captain active at the time was a man named Robert Searle. Now, I didn't really give Robert Searle the time that his story deserves when we talked about the Port Royal privateers, and we don't have time here today to do it either. But he, if not for Morgan, would have been number one, the most famous and most notorious. Robert Searle sailed with Mings and Mansvelt, if you'll recall those two, in the really early days of Port Royal. And it was on one of those voyages that he earned his ship Cagway. He was among the most prominent captains to sail with Edward Morgan, Henry Morgan's uncle, on the voyage that would claim Edward's life, which marked a decline in Robert Searle's career. Under Governor Modiford, and thanks to the shifting politics back in Europe, Robert Searle found himself turned from something of a go-to guy in Port Royal to a pariah. In an attempt to turn all of this around, he captured a huge prize, two Dutch merchantmen filled with slaves and plunder, and a not insubstantial amount of hard coin. He brought them into Port Royal. He unloaded the governor's share of slaves and coin, and they were still sitting in the harbor when a letter arrived from London. An order signed by the king telling them to cut all of this privateering out. Now that letter was dated prior to Searle's capturing of those two Dutch vessels. And because the king's signature is what made it an official document, that's when it goes into effect, on the date that he signed it. Even though it had just arrived, and everybody, including Searle and Modiford, just learned about it, Modiford decided to make an example of Robert Searle. He tried to arrest the now pirate for his crimes, even though nobody knew it was a crime at the time. But Robert Searle, always on his toes, managed to escape. Now, I told you last time that Charlestown in the Bahamas, what would become Nassau, served as a kind of last resort, a hideout for the buccaneers, a place to relax while the heat dies down. It served the same purpose here for Robert Searle, or at least he wanted it to. Instead, when Cagway arrived, the town, the island of New Providence, was in turmoil. The people had just endured a terrible attack by the Spanish. Murder, rape, theft, burning. Real pirate stuff. Robert Searle and his men, they were outraged, and they decided to do something about it. So the Cagway, along with a ship that was accompanying him and a number of smaller vessels from there at Charlestown, decided to sail out for a bit of revenge. Now, we talked about this raid way back when. It really, really upset the Spanish. Played a role in the instigation of the Second Anglo-Spanish War. We're talking about a fleet of ships, a small fleet, but a fleet nonetheless of pirate ships sailing into the harbor at St. Augustine and opening fire with the big guns. They set one of the ships in the harbor alight, and then landed a party ashore to murder and rape and steal and burn. There was a long-running feud between Charlestown in the Bahamas and St. Augustine. They traded blows back and forth all the time, and this could have been another one of those, but this time, thanks to the firepower and leadership that Robert Searle brought to the table, this was worse. The raid took some time. They had their way with the town for several days. And it was in that time that Dr. Woodward had a chance to escape. Now, again, he doesn't chronicle his escape, or at least a chronicle of it has not come down to us. We don't have the details, but you just know that it was an amazing story. I imagine Dr. Henry Woodward, in the dead of night, asleep in a cushy bed in a fine house, but a house that served as his prison, probably the magistrate's home where he practiced his medicine. But he was awoken by screams, followed by gunshots. He would, get up and rush to the window, only to see a roving band of murderous pirates marching through the streets. If he was not a prisoner, if he was there of his own volition, why would he look at those men, covered in blood, and think, "This is my chance"? Maybe he sneaked downstairs, or maybe he opened his window and scaled the wall down. I imagine him running in the local Spanish militia, who would likely try to have captured him. They knew his face. But he fled, and finally, after running through a town that was on fire, he found the pirates. Pirates who, remember, would not have recognized him. They likely would have tried to kill him, or take a shot at him at least. But they either missed, or Dr. Woodward was a fast talker. The reality of the situation is this. For whatever reason, Dr. Woodward did choose to sail away with the pirates. There were those whispers that he would have preferred to stay in St. Augustine with the Spanish, that he was a traitor to England. But they were discredited, even during his lifetime. When the pirates left St. Augustine, Dr. Woodward went with them. He would sail on board Cagway, under Captain Searle, as the ship's doctor. But only for a while. He apparently traveled with several different buccaneer crews. The details here are even more scant than those in Carolina or St. Augustine. But we do know that in 1669, his ship crashed off of Nevis. The crew of that pirate ship, whatever ship it may have been, dispersed to other buccaneer crews in the region, but not Searle. He chose to stay there on Nevis. He had had word that there was yet another voyage sailing from Bermuda to colonize Carolina, and they were planning to stop off at Nevis on the way. And Woodward still owned a huge swath of the Carolina territory, so he decided to, rather than continue sailing with the buccaneers, to wait for them. Frankly, it's a kind of story that's hard to believe. If there were not such a sense of surprise and disbelief from the people that were on that Carolina fleet, and so much correspondence about Dr. Woodward and his questionable loyalties, if there had not been so much talk about him at the time, I wouldn't believe that story myself. But that is how it happened. Dr. Woodward would sail with the Carolina fleet from Nevis back to Carolina and the Kusabo chief. In fact, this was the voyage that brought his daughter back to him. It appears that the leaders of this expedition expected to find Dr. Woodward here, with the Kusabo. He was supposed to have been gathering information, but instead they found him on Nevis. Still, he did have those copious notes about the Carolina territory. He had a ton to tell them. He was integral to their founding of Charlestown in Carolina, modern-day Charleston. For the rest of his life, Dr. Woodward would be one of the most prominent figures in Charlestown. Not a politician, really, but, I mean, he owned the territory. He made a killing on the founding of Charlestown. He would also serve as one of their doctors, but none of that is why Dr. Woodward is most well known. There's a story, probably an apocryphal story, but it's widely repeated, about Dr. Woodward and the arrival of Rice in Carolina. Thanks to his years as a buccaneer surgeon, Dr. Woodward had contacts in the seedier side of the Atlantic maritime trade. One such associate was a man named John Churcher, a figure that we introduced last time. He was an interloper, a pirate, and an agent of Frederick Phillips, as well as a customer of Adam Baldridge. John Churcher sailed the coasts of Africa and Madagascar for years before Adam Baldridge ever arrived. He was intimately familiar with those waters. That apocryphal story tells us that in 1687, John Churcher stopped off at Charlestown, Carolina to take in wood and water. There he met with Dr. Woodward, who it appears he already knew, and mentioned that he had a bag of seed rice on board. Malagasy rice from Madagascar. Now, I don't want to delve into the entire history of rice here, but indigenous American rice, what's often called wild rice, is a different species from traditional rice. Now, Europeans and Native Americans, obviously, were cultivating that all over the Americas. But this story, again, probably not true, this story would have you believe that John Churcher introduced the first foreign rice, in this case Malagasy rice, to America. Henry Woodward took that rice and found that it grew really amazingly well in Carolina. Now, that's probably not how it happened. Rice from Asia and Africa, different varieties, were being grown all around Central America and the Caribbean. Most historians believe that that rice could have found its way up to Carolina with ease already. Perhaps, though, not Malagasy rice, which really, really took off in Carolina. I mean, you plant the stuff and it just, you know, it takes over. You've got so much you don't know what to do with it. So much that the colonists can't hope to plant and harvest all of it on their own. They're going to need to bring in outside labor. That is what John Churcher introduced to Carolina. Not a bag of seed rice they could have bought from any passing merchant, but slaves. At least, illegally obtained slaves, cheap labor for the Carolina rice farms. Dr. Woodward, thanks to his ties to the pirates so familiar with the coast of Africa, would build an entirely new market for illegally obtained slaves. A market that was suddenly very, very important. Growing all of that rice was a big deal for the English Empire. You know, rice keeps really well on board a ship, and you don't have to rely, in that case, on imported grain or what little grain Britain can produce. Charlestown, Carolina became, within just a few years of its founding, one of the most important food suppliers of the English-speaking world. One of the most prominent cities in America, thanks to all of that. And yeah, they bought slaves from time to time from the Royal Africa Company. You can't buy all of your slaves under the table or somebody is going to notice. But most of those, thanks to their ties to St. Mary's and New York, to Adam Baldridge and Frederick Phillips, most of those were illegally obtained. Because of that, so many people who operated outside of the law as interlopers and smugglers, who would go on to become pirates of the round in just a couple of years, well, they all became intimately familiar with the swamplands very nearby, lands in which they could hide from the authorities almost indefinitely. Because of all of that, Charleston, South Carolina, is about to become one of the most important pirate haunts in all the world. It's the missing piece between Madagascar and Nassau and New York. Next time, we're going to look at a different Charles. Not a town, but a ship. A Spanish ship called the Charles II, or really Carlos II. It was a ship on which William Dampier and a former Navy man named Henry Every were about to book passage. I'd like to thank everybody for listening. I'd like to thank everybody who has helped to support the show, everybody who has signed up to become a patron on Patreon, and there have been so many of you lately. I can't begin to express my appreciation. Thank you. And everybody who has spread the show around, recommended it to your friends and family, online or in real life, and everybody who has rated or reviewed the show, that really helps get this show noticed. Thank you, all of you. For many of you, this will be our last episode of 2020. I'd like to take this opportunity to hope that everyone out there had a happy and safe holiday season, and wish you a happy 2021. Our theme music, as always, was The Old Captain by the fantastic band Brillig. If you haven't checked them out yet, you absolutely should do so. You can find them at brillig.com.au. That's B-R-I-L-L-I-G.com.au. After you're done over there, why not check out our website at piratehistorypodcast.com. As always, and most importantly, thank you for listening.
Live on in legend tonight.